Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. I am Curtis Davis, a.k.a. The Illuminated One, and today we have back with us a very good friend of mine, and if you've heard the information that he shared with us in previous show appearances here, you know that we're in for a treat. It's always a pleasure having him here. That's why I bring him back so much. You know, not only is he a great teacher, metaphysician, he's even an even better person. I'm talking about Lon Milo Duquette. So I'm going to get through these introductions so we could get to the powerful information that Lon always shares with us. Believe me, I was looking forward to this day. So we're going to start off by thanking our sponsors, Per Ankh Incorporated, House of Life. That's www.perankh.org. And the Ancient Mysteries Bookstore, which can be found right here on Occult Science Radio's main page in the links, as well as at the bottom of the page where you'll also see our Occult Science Radio Book Club. And you'll also find a lot of the literature there in our book club and in our store that's written by many of our guests. So please call in with your questions at 646-649-1987. That's 646-649-1987. And please press number 1 so we can see you on the switchboard and take your wonderful questions and comments. Okay, we've gotten through that. Now it's time to bring my good friend to the forefront. Lon, welcome back, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me. Happy April Fool's Day.
Oh, likewise. A great day to have this this show and this discussion, huh?
it's perfect.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, well, no introduction is needed, Lon. You're a part of the family. You've been here several times before, and you're going to be back several times more. So let's just get right into it, my friend. You know, let's lots of it have been going on. You've been teaching a couple of seminars, and you know, I plan on taking some of those seminars in the future, but I've been following you on Facebook, and you've been teaching some great seminars. But, we're going to talk about those, and let's start off talking about the one who has become most identified with esoteric practices, if you will, Aleister Crowley.
Okay. Yes. Well, he's quite a subject. We could... Of course, we could have a whole series of shows on Crowley.
Oh, yes.
And you know, I don't want to correct anybody's pronunciation about anything. So don't think I'm correcting your pronunciation. But Crowley said his name rhymed with holy. If you hear me saying Aleister Crowley, that doesn't mean that you have to call him Aleister Crowley. You can pronounce, it's like Hebrew. There is no correct Hebrew pronunciation. There are correct dialects, but if you can spit the words out, that's good enough as it is. Crowley, you know, still has a bad reputation. And I think if he were alive, or if he was looking down from the astral plane, or wherever people hover in between incarnations, or whatnot, he would probably still be giggling that he's got it. That people are still afraid of him. Just a couple of years ago, I was channel surfing, and I was flipping the television from channel to channel like men do. And I flipped over the one of the religious channels. And I stopped because I saw Aleister Crowley's, a picture of Aleister Crowley, the one where he looks like Uncle Fester. You know, it's the same one the Beatles used.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that one. And I said, oh, I better stop and listen to this one. And I listened to what the man had to say, and of course he was warning his listeners against getting involved with this guy, that he was a 14th century black magician who is still alive today and running the world's drug trade.
Wow.
And this was and they said all sorts of terrible things about him, but not one historical thing that he was. It's just like they could have said, and this is the boogeyman, and he lives on the moon, and he eats green cheese, and I think Crowley would have really gotten a kick out of that. He was a wild and crazy guy. He was a very, I would say he was an eccentric Englishman, but that's sort of like redundant.
Hell yes.
Yeah. Lots of Englishmen are eccentric, and even more than Crowley was. But he was a brilliant man. He was a genius. He had an incredible sense of humor. But he was a genius. And sometimes regular people don't understand what geniuses are about, and I certainly don't. I'm a very very average kind of intelligence person. But have you ever had a friend, or have you ever made the acquaintance or attempted to have some kind of a relationship, a business relationship or some kind of a artistic relationship with a brilliant filmmaker or a poet?
Oh, yes.
Or a virtuosic musician or an opera singer? Now, there are plenty of just normal good guys and perfectly lovely individuals in all of these fields, but someone who is extraordinarily brilliant, and at first you're flattered and you feel good that you can have this relationship with this individual, and go places with him, pick him up at the airport, take him around. You feel, oh, hey, I'm hobnobbing with a genius. And then you discover that they are almost dangerously unstable.
Yes, indeed.
they can turn on you at the drop of a hat. They can misunderstand your words. They can throw fits. Because they are so focused on their art that it completely clouds everything else that a normal person does to be, a socially acceptable person, and they can turn your world upside down.
True indeed.
Well, that's how Crowley was. Okay, only his art was his magic, and so it made him a very awkward person to have any kind of personal relationships, and so part of his flaw, I guess, is that he assumed everybody else was as much a genius as he, and who got his strange and in many places twisted sense of humor. And all along, most of the people just weren't getting it. So he was born in 1875, and his parents were he's an Englishman. He's born in Leamington Spa in England, and his parents were involved, committed members of a very conservative Christian fundamentalist sect called the Elect Brethren, and it was a branch of the Derbyite sect, the Plymouth Brethren.
Mm-hmm.
Now, believe it or not, this particular sect and this particular set of teachings by this guy named Darby was the archetype of what we now today consider the modern evangelical movement. These are the people that invented the concept of the rapture, of the various tribulation periods, the Channel 40 kind of Christian television, Southern Pentecostal Christian movement really isn't an ancient movement at all. It was really invented around 1860, 1870, and
mm-hmm.
It was invented by these by Darby and these people. And so Crowley's parents were at the forefront of, I guess you'd say, the modern evangelical movement, and they were fanatical members. And his father was a wealthy brewer and had a lot of money, and his father was a lay preacher. And Crowley's only literature for the most of his childhood was the Bible, which he really knew forward and backwards. And his father died when he was 11, and he was shipped off to an assortment of English boys' schools. And if you've read anything about the English boys' schools of that period, that right there would be enough to make a disturbed person out of an adult. But he was a bright kid. But when he finally went off to college, went off to Cambridge, he became very interested in poetry, and once he was kind of free from that very restricted upbringing, he did what most most young people do, no matter how they're brought up, they start to rebel against kind of what they saw as you know, their stifling upbringing. And Crowley rebelled in high style, and he got very interested through poetry. Poetry gave him a glimpse at I guess lyrical ecstasy. And I guess in his upbringing, ecstasy was a rare commodity, and so he became kind of sexually active. At the same time, he was discovering poetic inspiration, and all of that came together because he always wanted to have this a religious spiritual part of his life, but he didn't like the brand of it that he was brought up with, but still he yearned for that. And he started to put all of this together, the poetic or interest in poetry and great literature, and the ecstasy that verse can produce, and that got him interested in esoteric things like alchemy, and he ended up joining an occult order called the Golden Dawn, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, in around 1900. And he became literally a magician, as we would think of in the modern sense of the term. And he went through the Golden Dawn grades very, very fast. And kind of ironically and sadly, he joined the Golden Dawn just about at the twilight of its own existence. He joined the Golden Dawn just in time for it to break up, in other words. And not only that, but his kind of outrageous character sort of expedited the breakup of the Golden Dawn. And probably the biggest moment in at least his early life was shortly after he got married. He got married in 1903, and he took his wife to on an extended honeymoon, and all around the world. Not all around the world, but he went to Burma and the Far East and the Near East, and they discovered that she was pregnant, I guess, when they were in Egypt. And they decided, rather than go back to their home at Loch Ness, Scotland, isn't that romantic? they decided to stay where it was nice and warm in Cairo, there in the winter and early spring of 1904. And his wife, one evening, fell into a trance. And his wife wasn't interested in magic at all. She knew nothing about his magical career. He had more or less given up magic when he married her, and he didn't. But she fell into a trance, and she mentioned that the gods had a message for Crowley, and this irritated Crowley because she was not a magical person, knew nothing about this. He thought she was teasing him for a while, but it seemed after a while that she was in a legitimate trance of some kind, and he would ask her. He asked her questions about, what God is this that is trying to get a message through to me? And as it turned out, she said, it's the god Horus. And, of course, it's, one of the main Egyptian gods, Horus. It's the son of Isis and Osiris. And, And a part of her message was that the god Horus not only had a message for Crowley, but that he was a little miffed with Crowley, that he felt that Crowley had snubbed him. And this was a very odd thing for his wife to be saying, because in a very kind of strange backdoor way, Crowley had, if you can snub an Egyptian god, Crowley had, you know, during the years of the breakup of the Golden Dawn, Crowley had more or less consciously eschewed the pet gods of his enemies in the Golden Dawn, particularly MacGregor Mathers, whose I guess pet god was Mars, and all of the corresponding martial kind of gods of war of other cultures. So, in other words, Crowley was in the midst of a little almost childish argument with MacGregor Mathers, as if to say, "I hate you, I hate your gods." You know, he was throwing a little fit. "I hate you, I hate your gods." Yeah, so I'll invoke everybody, but I won't invoke your god because I don't like you. Kind of. it's an argument that's kind of hard for guys like us to understand, but that, nonetheless, it was a real thing for Crowley. And here is this Egyptian equivalent to what Crowley was snubbing, actually speaking through his wife, saying, "Hey, I'm kind of mad at you for snubbing me." And it was an odd thing, and it sort of hit Crowley in an odd way. And so he made up a whole list of questions to ask his wife Rose about the nature of this god, this so-called god that was trying to communicate with him. And if you're familiar with the tables of correspondences that more or less unify the archetypal gods of every culture, you can find table lists of things that, you know, Zeus is the Greek Jupiter, who is the Norse Odin, who is the Polynesian whoever, you know. There's only so many, you know, deity archetypes that the human hardwired system has within us, and you can more or less draw parallels through all the cultures. So he asked her, "Well, what is this god's, you know, favorite color? What is this god's traditional clothes? Who are his enemies? Who are his friends? Who was his mother? Who was his father? What are his magical weapons? You know, what are his words?" And Rose, who had no education in this whatsoever, kept coming up with the right answer time and time again until the odds of her guessing became astronomical. And Crowley finally gave up that night and said, "Look, I'll take you to the museum tomorrow, and you can show me this god that wants to talk to me." And that's what they did. They went to the Bulaq Museum, which is now the Cairo Museum. And she walked past most of the classic images of Horus, you know, the hawk statues with the crown.
Oh, yes.
And so Crowley was kind of sniggering there, at the end of the hallway, I guess it was up on the second floor, was this stele. Just a pretty unassuming funeral stele. But she was even from across the room, she pointed to it and said, "There, the god is in there." And they walked up to it and took a closer look at it, and it was indeed a funeral stele that had an image of the god Horus, in his sort of hybrid characteristic that was popular in the 26th or 25th dynasty, called Ra Hor Kuit, sort of a combination of Horus and the sun god Ra. And the god is enthroned there on the on his throne, and there's arching over the top of it, of the whole stele, is this beautiful goddess Nuit, who's the goddess of the night sky, and a beautiful winged solar disk at her heart, and there is there's a priest that's serving at a table of offering before the god, and it's a lovely stele, and it's everywhere now, but she says, there he is. That's who's trying to talk to you. And that interested Crowley very much, but what interested him even more and immediately was it just, they looked at the fine print on the little identifying marks on the stele, and it was the stele museum number was number 666.
Mm.
And ever since Crowley was a rebellious little boy, he identified with the beast 666. Now, at first, it was just to make his mother mad. But when like even my mother, here's a confession, Curtis. Even my mother, when I was naughty, would shake her finger at me and say, "Little Lonnie, you're possessed with the devil." And what a thing to tell a kid, huh?
Oh, yeah.
But his mother did the same thing with him. "You're the beast 666. How you get in the house here, you know?" But once he joined the Golden Dawn and started to study the Hebrew Kabbalah, you know, we study the Hebrew Kabbalah, and you soon find out that 666 is, you know, not a bad number at all. On the contrary, mm-hmm. it's a very wonderful number. It's gotten a bad rap over the years. So. but anyway, Crowley had the stele translated and had a reproduction of it made. And meanwhile, he and Rose went back to the hotel and did whatever it was they did to get her in that trance. And Crowley continued the conversation. "Okay, what do you want me to do? What's your message for me? You know, I'm listening." You know. And to make a super long story just long, the Rose, or speaking through Rose, the intelligence or whatever it was that was speaking through her, told Crowley more or less this story, that the age had changed. That the age had changed, and there is a magical formula that sort of dictates not only the forms of religious expression, but the it dictates what works and what doesn't spiritually in any given age. And that age is more or less dictated, and the formula of that age is dictated by the general level of human consciousness.
I see.
So crudely speaking, the more uninformed, unenlightened humanity is as a whole, there's different forms of spiritual expression, and that the smarter humanity gets, as human consciousness raises in frequency, as the human understanding of the world around us improves, our spiritual point of view needs to improve too. And basically, it's as simple as that. Now, there was a time in human consciousness when we didn't know where babies came from. We didn't have a 9-month attention span. And so the magic forms of expression are dictated on around what we perceive is the truth. And when we don't know where babies come, we perceive that the truth is they come spontaneously from a woman. And so the magical formula of that age is the woman. And just like the earth is a big woman, the earth gives nourishment directly, just like the woman's teat gives nourishment directly. The animals come spontaneously from the earth, just like babies come spontaneously from women. The plants grow spontaneously from the earth, just like babies come spontaneously from a woman. Do you follow the logic here? So when we're that, I don't want to say ignorant, but when a level of our consciousness is that simple, the religious forms of expression all revolve around the adoration and the respect, the worship of women, of the woman, of the mother, and by that a little less abstractly, the earth itself. Okay, but after a while, when human consciousness raises a bit, we start to put two and two together that unless the woman has had some kind of a relationship, physical relationship with a man, sometime, you know, we started to have a 9-month attention span. Okay. And we started to put two and two together, and the same time we put two and two together about the woman needing the intervention of a man, we were starting to put two and two together that the earth needed the intervention of the sun.
Oh.
Okay, and so the woman needs a man, the sun, the earth needs the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Woman can't have a baby without a man. The earth can't bring forth plants without the sun. Okay, so the magical formula, what works now needs to be improved a little, and so so we move from a culture, a religion, a magical formula that Crowley calls the age of Isis, where the woman and the earth is exalted. The pendulum swings after a while when we discover the necessity of the man, and then that's the age of Osiris, and everything is now sun-related. And what does the sun do? The sun is born in the morning and it dies at night. It teeters toward extinction in the winter and comes back in the spring. And so all of a sudden we're starting to put two and two together and go, oh, the magic of the sun god is that life comes from death. And as long as we keep killing things, things will keep being born. And so now the magical formula moves to this idea of sacrifice. So throughout the Osirian age, people all over the world, the major form of worship is human sacrifice. And that human sacrifice then evolves into subtler forms of sacrifice, into animal sacrifice, and then even into grain and water and wine sacrifice, and then into the sacrifice of bread and wine. But you see what I'm talking about, what the formula is.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
and
the most striking example of a religious expression and the spiritual magic, if you will, of that Osirian formula is the Christian formula. Just the story, the myth of the surrounding Christ's life, the death,
the resurrection, the eating of his body and blood, all of that. It's so Osirian that it's comical. So now we've got an old Egyptian god that's telling Crowley, humanity's consciousness has raised enough. Now there is a new magical formula. We still love the goddess. We still love the earth. We still love, you know, the mother. We still love the father. But their age has passed, and what we need to focus on now is their child. And the formula of the child isn't nourishment like the mother's was, and it isn't death and resurrection and sacrifice like the father's was. The magical formula of the child is simply growth. Simple evolution and growth. And the thing that made humanity's consciousness raise up just that little notch higher in frequency is the fact that we now know and have known for several hundred years all over the planet that the sun does not die. The sun does not die every night. And it doesn't teeter toward extinction every winter. The sun stays on all of the time. And night is just an illusion. Winter is just an illusion. It's a cold one. And by that same token, death is an illusion. The sun stays on all the time. We stay on all the time. If it appears that we die, well, I'm sorry, it's just as much of an illusion as of what happens at night. The sun stays on all the time. And I guess enough people on the planet have got that little shift in consciousness enough to where in 1904, the god Horus was telling Crowley, the age has changed. It's not my father's age anymore. It's not my mother's age anymore. It's my age. And so that was the big message. And almost from that moment forward, everything in Crowley's life became associated with that new good news, if we want to use the old evangelical, the good news that the sun stays on all the time, that we stay on all the time, that death is an illusion. And so the magical formula has changed, and Crowley was an expert on the magical formula of the past. And I guess he was chosen, or he chose himself, however you want to look at it, because he really had a grasp of what all of this was really about. Not only that, his magic education gave him a vocabulary to express what was going on. His magical education and his magical mastery of different forms of ceremonial religious expression gave him the ceremonial vocabulary to communicate this new magical formula in rites and observances and personal and even public magical forms of expression. So that's what Thelema, that's at the very basis of Crowley's religion, if we want to call it that, or philosophy, if you want to call it that. The philosophy of religion, of Thelema, which is a Greek word, it's one Greek word for will. If you've ever raised a child, you know that they are willful.
To say the least.
And grandchildren are also beautiful. They're innocent. They're cruel. They're childish. But throughout all of their shortcomings, they continue to grow. And they grow into adults. And they grow into adults. They evolve without having to die and be magically brought back to life. Okay, they grow. It's the natural momentum of evolution, and that's the cornerstone of Thelemic thought.
I see.
Aren't you sorry you asked?
I know, I'm enjoying this. This is wonderful. That's why I keep you coming back, because there's always so much to share. But yes, my friend, you know, we talk a lot privately, and you know, you have a very high expertise in Enochian magic, and you had something special that you wanted to share with us today. Please feel free.
I didn't know, you know, because I do a couple of these shows a month, and I've been on your show a couple times, and sometimes I forget what I do on shows, and sometimes I don't. But we were talking about the Enochian magic of John Dee, the angelic magic of, you know, Queen Elizabeth the First. Court magician, I guess we could call him that. And we were talking about Enochian magic, and he developed a system where he was taught by intelligences that at least claim to be the same type of intelligences, the same intelligences that communicated with biblical patriarchs. And they taught him a language which sort of opened up, not only did they teach him a language, and it's a real language, too, that's studied by amazed linguists that have no interest in occultism whatsoever, that their minds are just blown by this phenomena. But they were given a series of calls that were designed to sort of trigger higher and higher levels of consciousness within the person reciting it and the person listening to it. And these levels of consciousness, they sort of metaphorically called heavens or airs or aethers. And if you can imagine that our everyday consciousness is the lowest heaven of, let's say, 30 heavens, and the highest heaven itself is the you know, theoretically the consciousness of the Godhead that is sustaining the entire universe, and the lowest one is what you and me wake up with every morning. The consciousness that says, I gotta have a cup of tea. And that these 30 different calls are designed to take you step by step from the very lowest to the very highest. And when after you do this call, if you're in the right frame of mind, you can experience a little vision, and the vision lasts, you know, as long as your energy holds out. And if you're conscientious about taking notes about every one of these visions, it's a very, very practical and helpful magical discipline. You can look at it as like a 30-part meditation, and of course, you know, not all of us get all the way to the top and dwell in our consciousness in that Godhead all the time, but every time we do it, we peel back a few more membranes of the veil, and it can be very helpful in a magician's program of spiritual development. And I asked you before we came on if I ever recited one of these calls for our listeners, and because I have forgotten, I've done it on Coast to Coast AM and other radio programs, and no one has called in and complained yet. So I thought, if you don't mind, I'd be happy to read one of the calls.
Please.
For you, so you could hear the language, and remember this. These aren't just barbarous words of evocation. These aren't nonsensical words. They were given to Dee and Kelly back in the 1500s, and they were dictated by in vision by angels and written down, and then later they were given their English translations. And much to the amazement of even modern linguists, it was proved to be a real language with grammar and syntax and all the parts of speech and can be translated just as easily as German or Greek, or it's a pretty wild thing. But anyway, here's the 19th the call, and I'll use it to open up just the heaven or the level of consciousness that is just as close to the earth plane, I guess, as we get. So here we go. Madrias dies proftex. Kis mi kaolus senir kaosgo, od fifis balzesras iada. Nonka gohulim, michma adoyan mad, yaud bli orb. Soba uana kis lusiftias paripsal. Dies abresa nons ni taib kaosgi, og tilda tfintum plaz. Tuat nons gi mi kaosoma, Elaz taf glo marb yari ido ego. Hotel zult yaud af kohol. Ka uz gatabi yard simir. Hot Christios il poil tiobel bezdir tibl noan pai dols ba doderem nizilna. El zep tilb barmji paripsax. Hot aquels buapes el nibem ucho simp. Od Christios agel toton mir quae tiobelelel, ton peim dils moas pian. Od Christios agel toton paraca simp. Corgis, tot balod fifis ers minad. Od farcht bams um mavas, conis bra u ava vax tonug. Osca tibel noas mitabges levismong, uncium tibelors. Baglei, mua ol cordis. El capimao ixo maxit, o caco cusabgo se, baglen piti anta a babalonda, od farch teluc vovim. Madriax torzu, o adriax orocha abro apri. Tabiori priars ar tabas adrepan curus te dubix, il cam priasiar coasior od quas quetin. Ripir pavax agacor, umelod pridzar cacoie oive compt. Torzu, zakar, od zamran as psipsibut mona, dies surzas tia baltan, od osicle quae, od da zazma plapli, iad namad. And when we do that in a group setting, we sit quietly for about 10 minutes with subdued light, and then we discuss was going on in our minds as we were listening to that, and what visions we saw after it was recited.
And I see.
Other little techniques that you do, but that's basically it. Are you still with me, Curtis?
Oh yes, definitely. Amazing. You know, and yeah, you know, ever since you know, we've been corresponding online, believe me, you've definitely you know, increased my my interest, my curiosity in Enochian magic. And you know, it's a very interesting study, you know, and you know, especially you know, with Thelema as well. And, oh, God, you know, we're winding down, unfortunately, but that's good, because I constantly keep you coming back, so
oh,
we'll
good.
Touch on it. Yeah, but definitely, next time you come on, you know, I want to talk more about John Dee, you know, because usually when we talk about the occult, you know, we talk about magic, the first thing that comes to everyone's mind is, you know, like we said, Aleister Crowley. But John Dee, you know, a lot of people are unfamiliar with John Dee, but John Dee was a major player in occult esoteric circles.
Yeah, not only that, he was a major player in world politics of at a very pivotal time in history. He was a major player on Earth. I've written a book called Enochian Vision Magic, and that hopefully it's not only a good introduction to Dee's magic, but it's a practical guide to get somebody started in actually applying the techniques of Enochian magic just immediately. And I guess all it really requires is enough confidence in yourself and in your own innate goodness to have the courage to actually do it. In my years of practicing magic, I've learned that truly there is nothing to be afraid of in doing magic, in doing any forms of ceremonial magic. The only thing to be afraid of is being afraid of it. And,
true indeed.
If you're just confident in your own innate goodness, there's nothing that could hurt you. So, and besides, you can get hurt walking across the road, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, so.
You know, how many of us got hurt just getting up in the evening on our way to the restroom, stubbed our toe?
There you go. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't try to make that trip when you need to.
Yeah, right. True. But yeah, my friend, take some time to tell us about these great workshops that you have going and you've got coming up. And yeah, cause like I said, I've seen it on Facebook. And tell us about your new website, your Ning site, and
yeah.
Anything else you may want to share.
Well, my first of all, my website is just, you know, www.lawnmiloduquette.com. And but if you're on Facebook, please, you know, follow me at least on Facebook. You know, Facebook only gives you 5,000 friends, and I've hit my limit. But I also have a Facebook fan page that I'm not near that limit. And if you would go to Lawn Milo Duquette and be my fan. Every time I've got a new workshop or something coming up, I always make the announcement on Facebook. And so I'm going to be in Chicago next week. And believe it or not, after all this magic stuff, you might not believe this, but before I was magician. I was a musician and a songwriter. And the last few years, I've picked up the guitar again. And I always wrote songs that were kind of spiritual and occult and kind of edgy. And so I'm back doing that again. And now I guess every place I've been going so far, I've, you know, set up a couple of workshops and a concert too. So if you're at all interested in my music, it's just me and my guitar. I'm just kind of like a diabolic folk singer, I guess. But if you're interested in my music, I've got a couple of my tunes on YouTube, and if you just Google YouTube and Long My Little Cat, you'll hear a couple of my songs. And if you enjoy that kind of thing, and I've been lucky enough to be booked in some very some real clubs, so it's another aspect of Lon Duquette that I'm exposing myself to the world with. But if you enjoy music and edgy little songs, give that a listen too. So.
Ah, excellent. Once again, my beloved friend, you know, not only coming from me, but from the entire family, we offer you a heartfelt thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us today on Occult Science Radio. Always a pleasure to have you. And knowing me, I'm going to be in your ear probably within the next 24 to 48 hours to set up your next visit.
Okay.
You know, and yeah, once again, my friend, we want everybody to go to, I put the link in the chat room, and everybody please visit that Ning site. There's so much information there to be shared. And for those who are also unfamiliar, get a copy of the DVD, The Great Work. You know, another extraordinary work by Lon. But once again, my friend, thank you so much, and peace be with you. And I'll be talking to you very shortly.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, my friend. Much love to you. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
And thank you too, beloved family, for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here with us this evening on Occult Science Radio. Tune in tomorrow evening when we will have Asar Imhotep. That's going to be a treat. This is going to be his second time with us. But thank you so much for listening in. And peace, love, and power, beloved family. And please, please walk with strength. Peace.
Walk in the light. Won't you wake up, wake up, walk in the light? Won't you wake up, wake up, bring substance in your life? Won't you wake up, wake up, walk in the light? Won't you wake up, wake up, yeah? Where's your heart, where's your pride? Has it all been pushed aside? Life is dreams, living high, yet
need to shine, yeah.